Good morning. We're glad you're here this morning. I brought my bag. It was suggested by somebody that we should give everybody one of these and you could wear it this morning during the message, you know, because you have those awkward moments, you know, as we're talking about sex. Can you believe that you showed up at church and actually are coming to a church where they're talking about sex? It's kind of bizarre and kind of weird. We're in the middle of a series called Everybody Loves Marriage, and we can't really talk about marriage without dealing with this subject. I will let you know, while this morning will have definitely PG-13 content, we do not have any graphics, pictures, or diagrams, so you could rest assured and be comfortable with that. But we do have a lot to say, and I hope that you're kind of challenged this morning. I know that if you're like me, I came from a really traditional church background. Spent my life in a lot of traditional churches, and about the only thing we ever heard about this topic was, don't do it! You're a teenager, you're not married, don't do it! That's like all that anybody would ever say to us. But I do believe that it's important for us to deal with this issue for a number of reasons. Let me give you a couple of reasons why we're doing this talk this morning, why we're having this message and this challenge to you. First, it is an issue that the culture is talking about it, okay? Now, that's like, okay, Joe, obvious strikes again, right? You don't have to turn on really any TV show, even the news. I mean, good grief, they are using sex to sell everything on TV. I mean, just some of the commercials that come on that have nothing to do with anything about spirituality. I mean, come on. Dairy Queen Sundays? Seriously, people? Have you seen these commercials with the waffle cone and the ice cream? Oh my gosh. Our culture is talking about this issue and has all kinds of ideas, all kinds of things that they want to share. But in the midst of this, I really believe that people have questions. And another reason, especially those who are followers of Jesus, as we live in this culture that is so bizarre and weird and has so many ideas, but we know those ideas aren't from the Bible, I think a lot of times people who are followers of Jesus, or even those who aren't, but they're trying to figure out spirituality, they're trying to figure out what it means to have a fulfilled sex life and a joyous, happy, fulfilled life, are asking the question, but they don't know where to turn, because the church has been incredibly silent on this issue. Now, it hasn't always been that way, okay? You need to understand that the church, really throughout history, was not as prude about talking about this issue as we are now. In fact, back in the Bible, marriage was a little different, okay? Today we have this beautiful ceremony. We, have the bride in white, and the groom stands at the front. They come down the aisle, and they do this beautiful thing in front of everybody, and the preacher reads some scriptures. It says, do you, I do you, I do. They exchange rings. If they're really, you know, cool, they might have a unity candle, or maybe that's if they're not cool. That's kind of dorky now. Because some of the weddings I've been in are like, okay, that's like old school. We don't want to do that. And so they're doing different stuff. But they have this ceremony, and then the guy pronounces them man and wife. You may kiss your bride, and they're married. That's what we say, okay? Well, in old culture, really every culture up until the last 150 years, that was not what caused the marriage. In fact, in Bible times, it was really interesting. This is how a couple would get married. They would have a five-day or a three-day festival planned. They would have a huge party. And on day one of the festival, they would hold basically the wedding. This is what would happen, okay? So this is going to make some of you really uncomfortable. This is the way it was, okay? This is what would happen. They would hold a little bit of a celebration and a little bit of a ceremony. They would do it under this thing called a huppah, which I'll talk about in a little more detail next week. This kind of a veil that covered the two people who were getting married. And then this is what would happen. The bride and groom, after this little bit of a, you guys have been engaged for a while and now you're married or you're getting married, woohoo, they would take this hoop and they would put it in the bridal chamber where the husband and wife were going to go to. And they would go into this tent, they would close the tent door, and everybody else would stand outside the tent and wait for them, and they would go in and they would consummate the marriage. They would have sex with all their family and friends standing right outside the tent. And when they were done, they would come back out, open the door, and everybody would go, woo, yay, and cheer for them. How awkward would that be, okay? I know that just the idea of, like, you know, some people have talked to me about this. My parents kind of kicked around the idea of doing a brunch on Sunday morning. I didn't want to look my parents in the eye for 6 months after I got married. I mean, how awkward is it? Now, by the time we get to the Reformation, it gets even weirder because they still do marriage kind of the same way. In fact, Martin Luther, you know, the reformer, got married to a nun named Katharina von Born, and when they had their wedding night, their marriage, it was kind of the same thing where they held a little ceremony, then they went and consummated the marriage, and that meant you were married when you had a sexual relationship with a woman. And so they went into their bridal chamber, same idea, everybody's outside, but this time to make sure that they actually consummated the marriage, they sent a secretary in to take notes. Can you imagine that? The two of you in the bedroom, you know, in the hotel, and some guy sitting there going, good job, that was way to go. You know, that is weird. Now, the reason I'm saying to this to you is that there is this weird thing. Our culture is so willing and so free to talk about it, and the church has gone and hidden. And people want to know let's be honest. While it's weird talking about it, well, some of you are like, oh my gosh, right now, give me that bag. The truth of the matter is we live in a culture where a lot of people are asking questions and the church doesn't know how to answer them because we've kind of decided we're just, the best way to handle this is not to really talk about it except to tell people if you're not married, don't do it. But here's the third thing, the third reason why we're doing this message. Because the Bible is freakishly candid. The culture's candid. The church isn't sure how to talk about it, but God's word is unbelievably candid about sexuality and about God's plan. It deals with the bad part in gory details. There are some just psychotic sexual stories in the Bible. There are a lot of stories in the Bible that we are not going to make kids' coloring books out of, okay? That we are not going to include with a flannel graph in kids' Sunday school. We're not going to have the story of David and Bathsheba in backyard Bible clubs next week, okay? We are not going to tell the story of people like just the different people, even Solomon, and we'll talk about him a little bit later, but Solomon, as he got older, we're not going to include that story in our kids' curriculum. There's not going to be a video about it, okay? But the Bible doesn't hide these things. When people are rebellious and they fail miserably with their sexuality, the Bible doesn't hide those people. But the flip side of that is that the Bible also is an incredible book speaking into the lives of married people about this issue of sexuality. And that's what this morning is. If you weren't here last week, not that I'm that good or it was that challenging, but I would encourage you, if you weren't here last week, go back and listen to the message from our service last week, the first part of this called Rescuing Sex, where we really dealt with the theology of sex. Now, that sounds kind of weird. Kind of freaks my wife out that there's a spiritual dimension to sexuality and that there's a theology of sex. You know, she's just not quite sure what to do with that. But I want to tell you that the Bible has a lot to say about sex, and it does say, and it does deal with the fact that my relationship with my wife is always about something that is so much bigger. This, my relationship with her, is always about that, my relationship with God. Now, don't overdo that and come up with weird, cultic, sexual things that we do with God. It's an image. But even my intimacy with my wife is to help me understand something so much greater. That's why John Piper says this. John Piper says, God gave us sexual passion so that there would be language to describe what it means to cleave to him in love and what it means to turn from him to others. God gave us sexuality, this sexual passion, so that we could understand what it means to really dedicate myself, to commit myself to one person, and what it might mean if I was betrayed by that person and hurt. God wants us to see that it's that depth of relationship that we come to when we become a follower of Jesus. A follower of Jesus is somebody who says, out of all the possible gods in the world, I am following you and you only. And the Bible uses the language of sex and marriage as an image of what it is like for God when his people break their promise and break their covenant and walk away from him. And so sex is really given to us for something that's really great and really incredible to help us kind of understand on a level that relationship with God. But in the midst of that, the Bible talks about two sins with sexuality. We talked about this last week. First is the sin of having sex with the wrong person. The Bible's very clear. God created us for one relationship, husband and wife, a man and a woman together for a lifetime. And any sex, any level of sexuality. One of the questions that comes a lot to me is, how far is too far? That's the wrong question. The question is actually, when? Really, biblically, anything that is sexual outside of marriage is outside of God's perfect plan for us as people. Sex with the wrong person, that is a sin. But the other sin that the Bible is actually pretty candid and pretty clear about, and I'll show you from one passage of Scripture where you'll see it clearly, is unfulfilled sex with the right person is a sin. Now, you probably never heard that in church, did you? Heard the first part, probably never heard the second part. Probably never heard that when you're in a marital relationship, if your sex life is not fulfilling to the two of you, that actually is a sign of some sinful issues in your life. Now, I'm not saying that's easy. I'm just saying the Bible's actually pretty clear. And this morning, our goal is to help walk you through some passages, to have a little fun with them. I'm going to be honest. I hope you laugh. There was some really weird, nervous tension in the room last week. Okay? So everybody take a deep breath. Relax. This message got really weird. See, originally we planned this date, and I was like, okay, what are we going to do with all of our teenagers? Because this is really for married couples or those who are old enough that marriage is something that is on their radar screen. They at least are thinking about it. And the other thing is that my son was going to be in here, which would have been really weird, okay? And so I was thinking, we'll find something where teenagers choose to, they can go. Well, then it was World Changers Week. And by the way, we got 14 people who left yesterday morning, and they're in Muncie, Indiana this week, living the adventure for Jesus and making a difference by working and renovating homes this week. Be sure to pray for them. But when I found out they were going to be gone, I kind of went, okay, cool. I don't have to think about that. But then I realized that, oh my gosh, a whole bunch of our guys are going to be gone. Actually, a whole bunch of our people are not going to be here for church. And then I started thinking, it could be a really small crowd, which could make the awkwardness even weirder for those who are out there. Okay? Well, it's not too bad. We're not as many as we normally have, but hopefully you don't have this weird awkwardness going. You can take a deep breath and relax and laugh a little and have fun as we look at the Bible and show you that the Bible really has some clear things to say about this. And so I hope that you're challenged. I hope that if you're married this morning, you're challenged to have a great sex life with your spouse. And if you're not married, I hope that you're challenged to prepare for a great sex life with your spouse. And that you're thinking through, how do I save myself? But also, what happens once I get to that point? How can it be everything that I dreamed it would be? Because here's what happens, okay? Guys are like, before they get married, in their mind, they're like, yes, going to get married, and it's going to be like every night all the time. And then they're married about 2 weeks and they're like, what happened? It's not working out that way. And you know, there are struggles in this. And the truth is that sexuality for a married couple is an incredible microcosm of the entire marriage. When there is something broken in the sexuality, it is also a sign that there's probably something in the rest of the marriage is broken. Now, hear me. We're going to get to this in a little more detail in a few minutes. Sometimes people will say, that means you need to fix everything that's broken before you have sex. That's not the Bible's prescription. The Bible's prescription is both and. We're going to look at this, and we're going to wrestle with this, and we're going to struggle with some of the things, and we're going to talk about three basic things that we need to know. Married couples, I want to tell you, if you're here today and you're a married couple, you're by yourself, have your spouse listen to this later, okay, because we're going to address both men and women. Encourage them to listen to this. Three things that you need to know, and the first thing is you need to know the plan. Did you realize that the Bible actually does lay out a plan for a husband and a wife's sex life? If you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. If you don't have a Bible, right there at the end of your row, we have Bibles for you. We'd love for you to pass one down. We'd like everybody to have a Bible this morning. And in that Bible, we will be on page 818 in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. As we're talking about God's plan, that the fact that God does kind of spell out to married couples some things about the way their sex life should function, and the fact that there is a little bit of a plan. All right, let me tell you context. 1 Corinthians chapter, all of 1 Corinthians was written to a really whacked out church that lived. It would be like if we were going to write a church that was planted in Las Vegas, okay? Imagine in the middle of the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada, there was a new church. People who hadn't been Christians became Christians, and they're trying to figure out this thing called spirituality, and we were to write a letter to say, listen, this is how you live the Christian life. 1 Corinthians is that letter. It was kind of that same kind of culture where there was just prostitution and gambling, all kinds of crazy things. And Paul is, this guy named Paul is trying to write to them to explain how they live spiritually in the middle of that culture. And of course, in a culture like that, and a culture like ours, they began to ask questions of Paul about sex and sexuality. Can I be a Christian and just go ahead and have sex with whoever I want to? And in chapter 6, Paul addresses that and says no. He says it is a sin to have sex with the wrong person. That your body is not your own. That when you gave your life to Christ, you trusted him. You were bought with a price, and you need to glorify God with your body. Well, then some people say, well, should we just not have sex? And that's what Paul's about to answer that question. And he's going to address two groups. He's going to address single people and married people. And it's this simple. He says to single people, yes, that is a great option. The rest of 1 Corinthians 7 actually unpacks that as he says, it is a really good thing when a person is gifted with the ability to be celibate for their whole life. Because if they don't get married, they can really dedicate themselves to Jesus in a greater way. But if you have a sense of burning and a deep desire to be sexually intimate, that's probably a sign that being married is a good plan. But then he says to married people, no, that's not a good plan. So the question in chapter 7, verse 1, he says, now concerning the matters about what you wrote. See, they had asked him a question. They had written a number of things, said, we want to figure this out. And one of the questions is it okay for us not to have sex? And this is what he says. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. He says, listen, it's good not to have sexual relations with another person, with a woman or ladies with a guy if you're not married. And later in this chapter, and I'm not going to deal with it a lot or deal with it any more than just saying this, in this chapter he outlines how that ought to look in a person's life. But he says, but because we have passions and because of temptation. And the Greek word there, the original language, is the word porneia, which we get pornography. Because there's this pornographic urge in us that is very real. And if we don't have a way to flesh that out, that listen, let's be honest, we will find a way for that to show up in our lives. So, because of that, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. When he says have, he doesn't mean get married. He says you have your own, one woman, one man, for a lifetime. You need to be sexually involved with that person. Because, verse 3, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights and likewise the wife to her husband. You're like, oh my gosh, that's in the Bible. Guys, we have a verse. This is a good thing. A husband should, actually the idea here is fulfill his duty to his wife. And a wife should fulfill her duty to her husband. How often? Look at this, guys, you're going to like this. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Okay, so here you go. This is what he's saying. I stood on that platform, I looked my wife in the eye, and I said, I do. And what she didn't realize, I conned her into this. And guys, we all did this, okay? We conned her into this because it's in the Bible. This verse isn't read in very many wedding ceremonies, but it's there. It's part of the plan. We made a trade. I traded my body for hers, okay? Now, a few weeks ago, I was listening to the radio, and they were talking about the worst trades or the best trades, the most lopsided trades in sports history. And in St. Louis, everybody who's into sports knows about Brock for Broglio. In the 1960s, the Cardinals traded a guy named Ernie Broglio, an average pitcher, for a guy, a young upcoming star named Lou Brock. And Lou Brock went on to become one of the greatest Cardinals that ever played. He at one point in time held the baseball record for the most stolen bases in both a career and for a single season. He had over 3,000 hits. He was a great outfielder, won several gold gloves. Great player for some guy who was just a schmuck pitcher who lasted about another 2 years. And the Brock Broglio trade is kind of the things that the Cardinals, if you're a Cardinal fan, and you're really into sports, you still hold this over the Cubs because they made that trade with the Chicago Cubs. And some people still believe that that is part of the reason the Cubs never will win a World Series because they did stuff like that. They made this Brock for Broglio trade. But I want to tell you that the trade of my body for my wife's was a way worse trade for her than Brock for Broglio, okay? I am lumpy and round, and she is hot and gorgeous, and guys, we're all like this, okay? The trade of a guy's body for a woman's is not a good trade, but there are no givebacks. It's just the way it is. She made that trade. She may not have known it, but it's done. And now she walks around. If I want to stare at her rear end, that's my body. It's not hers anymore. I can do that. I have that right. It's in the Bible. Okay? And there are no givebacks in this. It's just the way it is. He says, listen, when you get married, the right to constantly deprive your spouse from intimacy was given away at the altar. You made a trade. Ladies, your body's not your own anymore. It's your husband's. Guys, your lumpy, hairy, disgusting-looking body is no longer yours. You made the trade, and that's the way God designed it. And so now, in a very real way, scripturally, I have authority over my wife's body. She has authority over mine, which means if she tells me I need to wear product in my hair, I wear product. It's just part of the deal. If she tells you guys that you stink, take a shower. It's her body. She can do with it what she wants. Go take a shower, put on some Axe spray, and smell good for her. It's her body. You're like, I know what you're thinking. I had no idea this was in the Bible, did you? You didn't know it was there, but it is very clearly. It's right there, 1 Corinthians 7. And so look what he says. He says, for the wife does not have authority over her body, the husband does not have authority over his. Verse 5, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Listen, it's very clear here. He says there is one reason and one reason alone why married couples should not have an active sex life. And it is if you decide by mutual agreement. This is not the wife saying, well, I'm just going to hold this over his head for a while. It's not the husband going, I'm just bored with this. It is by mutual agreement to devote yourselves to prayer. Paul is really trying to tell these people who are married in Corinth, listen, married couples ought to have the best sex life. Christian married couples ought to have the best sex life. It ought to be active, ongoing, and vibrant. And he says, listen, don't deprive, don't violate the struggles of the other person. Your body's not your own anymore. It's God's, first of all, but I made a trade. And now, in this area of sexuality, God has a plan, and the plan is this, that we have regular regular sexual relationship, and we don't deprive one another of that. And when we do, we are violating the scriptures. You're like, man, that's harsh. I didn't write this. I'm really glad Paul did, but I didn't write this. And the reason is because sexuality is a microcosm of the overall relationship in marriage. And when there is not a one flesh, the Bible deals with this over and over and over again as it compares marriage. And it says, listen, it is a one flesh relationship. When two people who are married are not experiencing sexual intimacy, it is almost impossible for there to be a one flesh closeness for those two people. That's the plan. It's very clear right there. What's keeping you from experiencing this? Is one of you using sex to control the other person? I mean, you don't mean to, but you're kind of like Deborah here where you drop hints and it's a way to get the other person to do kind of the things you want to do. Not biblical. Is it the kids? This is a big one. A lot of times people get married, and when they have children, those children become very important. And then there's this weird fear when they turn about three that you're going to be intimate and all of a sudden little eyes are going to be in the room, okay? And one of the most important things that you as a husband and wife can buy is a good lock for your bedroom door. If you don't own one, pick one up at Walmart today. That's important. What is it for you and your wife that is keeping you from living 1 Corinthians 7? Maybe for you, there are some issues there. From struggles and from other issues, from past relationships, whatever it is. Listen, I want to tell you, I'm not trying to say just jump through pain and forget about it. Or just maybe there's some physical struggles. But here's the deal. If you become like a couple that I heard about recently, that there was one night where she said no, and the next night to kind of get back at her, he said no. And next thing you know, it became a 12-year stint without the two people having sex. And they went to a pastoral counselor and said, how do we fix our marriage? If you end up where you're kind of in that spiral, you're in trouble. Because what happens is for the guy, he's going to burn. Once he's been sexually involved with somebody, it is a huge struggle for the guy. He is going to burn most times. And for the woman, she is going to long for the emotional connection that sexuality brings. And when those two people aren't finding that in each other, generally they will find it elsewhere. Whether it's on the internet, whether it's in an office relationship, somewhere that is going to show up and you're going to try to get your needs met. And instead of being two people who understand God's plan for sexuality that says, I'm not my own, I'm yours, I give myself away. And the woman says, I'm not my own, I'm yours, I give myself away. And all of a sudden, sex doesn't become about the latest fantasy or the coolest thing, but it becomes about two people who are in this relationship with one another, and they say, my life is about Jesus first, but it is about you because I have given myself to you, and my goal, my passion is to please you. If you don't come to that point as a couple, you'll never experience fulfillment in this and really in your whole marriage. That's why Elizabeth Elliot, I love this quote. She was talking to women primarily, but this is what she said. She says, the essence of sexual enjoyment is self-giving. You'll find that it is impossible to draw the line between giving pleasure and receiving pleasure. If you put the giving first, the receiving is inevitable. And this is what, I struggle with this too. In our sexuality, I want to be pleased. But when two people in a covenant relationship say, listen, my life's passion is to please you. Yes, sexually, but with every other area. All of a sudden, what happens to that relationship is it fits. You become two people, as Genesis chapter 3 say, who are completers of one another, that it works, and God honors that, and that's God's plan. And so what's keeping you from experiencing that? Whatever it is it too much TV? Is it work? Is it staying up too late doing other things? Is it the fact that you don't set aside time for this, that in the name of being spontaneous, you never get around to it with each other? Whatever it is, come back to 1 Corinthians 7, read it together, and make a commitment to God and each other that you will understand this passage and live it out. Listen, that kind of sex is the best sex. Just letting you know, bottom line, And so you need to know God's plan for this. But the second thing I want you to know is that you need to know your partner. You need to understand your partner. Now, I want you to turn over to Song of Solomon, chapter 4. Some of you who've been around church long enough are going, no, don't go there. Please not Song of Solomon. Some of you have been around church are like, yoo-hoo, yes, this is cool. Anyway, Song of Solomon is a series of love poems between two people who are passionately in love. And most of it is about their sex life. There's a whole book of the Bible. I told you the Bible was candid. And some of you are going to be so embarrassed as I read this and unpack chapter 4 to you. Others of you are going to be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that's in the Bible. It is. A whole book of the Bible that is dedicated to demonstrating to us what a great marital sexual relationship should look like. Now, here's the deal. Don't copy this. Your spouse and you will look different than Song of Solomon or Solomon and his Shulamite wife. Okay? But there's an image here of what it can and should be like for two people. Sadly, this is early in this guy named Solomon's life, and many of you who have read the scriptures and know understand that this guy decided instead of being dedicated to one, he ended up having many wives. And in fact, as the king of Israel, he ended up taking a whole bunch of wives and treaties and stuff and had over 600 wives, which is just beyond me. One's plenty in my house. Okay? Plenty. But this beautiful love poem, as Solomon got older, he lost it. But early in his life, he found the woman of his dreams, and they got married. And this is the story of their intimate relationship. It is songs and poems and thoughts and flirting with each other. And as we'll see in chapter 4, some really, I'm sorry I'm going to say this in church, erotic stuff. This is a picture of beauty in the context of marriage, okay? And so Song of Solomon chapter 4, it's on page 450 in the Bibles that we have. And I want you to read this, and I'm just going to show you what some of these things mean, and I'm going to be honest with you, okay? I'm sorry. Here, anybody need this right now? I'm going to be honest with you about what they are saying to each other. And in chapter 4, it begins with the husband, Solomon, speaking to his wife. He says, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are as doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Now listen, guys, don't use that one, okay? Don't walk up and say, you are so gorgeous. Your hair looks like goat hair. But there's an image, especially in Palestine, of these dark-colored goats who had this long, shiny hair that as they were on the mountains from a distance, that there was a glistening, a beauty to it that he is saying to his wife, listen, there's a beautiful comparison there. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them has lost its young. I love this. This is a poetic way of saying, you ain't lost none of your teeth and you keep them brushed. It's literally what he's saying. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes. Guys, don't use that one. Not a good idea. That have come up from the washing. You see that? And all of them bear twins. Not one of them has lost its young. It means she's got all her teeth and he likes that. Okay? That's a good thing. When he looks at her, she doesn't have this, you know, smile with like rotting teeth but for him, this is beauty, and he has a way to express it to her. It speaks the language of her heart. Third, verse 3, your lips are like scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of pomegranate behind your veil. Pomegranate's kind of apple. And man, do you see that? He's speaking into her life. How he views her as lovely and beautiful and wonderful. Verse 4, your neck is like a tower of David built in rows of stone. Now guys, don't look at your wife and say, man, you got tower neck syndrome. You got this long tower neck. That's what it sounds like he's saying. Let me go on and read the rest and I'll unpack this. Like the tower of David built in rows of stone, on it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Now, he's going to start talking about her breasts in a minute, and this is not him going, you got this long, weird, scrangly neck, and I have to come up with a poetic way to explain that I think is beautiful. It's not what he's saying. Okay? The neck for a woman is the part that leads to her breast, right? And here's what he's saying. He's saying, your neck is kind of like the strong tower that has had been guarded with people carrying shields. And you have protected yourself from that. We live in a culture where women in many places want to show as much of their body as they possibly can. They want everybody to see it, even before they're married or after they're married. And this is what he's saying to her. He's saying, listen, before we got married, you protected your body from being seen by eyes that weren't supposed to see him. And he's saying, I find that incredibly beautiful. You protected this part of your body. It's like a tower that had shields. You wouldn't let anybody through. You wouldn't let anybody see it. He is praising her for her modesty. And it's what he's saying, listen, I want to tell you, the fact that my eyes are the only ones that have seen this in you is freaking amazing to me. And then he goes on to the most uncomfortable verses in this passage, where he says, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, that graze among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. That means what it sounds like it means, okay? He is talking about her breasts and her sexuality and all this kind of stuff. And he says, they're like fawns, they're like twins of a gazelle. That just sounds weird. But don't think visually. This is a touch idea, okay? Wait, you see a little baby deer, what do you want to do? This is what he's saying, okay? He's saying, it's a petting zoo. Woohoo! You know, I mean, that's what he's talking about. All right? I can't believe he said that in church. Oh my gosh, it's in the Bible. Anyway, here we go. You are altogether, verse 7, you are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. And here's the thing I want to say to every person, especially every guy in this room. What he is doing is he is speaking her heart language. He is touching her heart before he touches her body. He is calling out to his love, his bride, and he is loving her. He's written her a poem. He's written her a song, and he is pouring into her life. And then he says, listen, you are the most beautiful person I know. I don't see any flaw in you. And here's the thing. I think this is so key, especially for guys, but really for all of us. Your body's not your own. You've given it away. We ought to work to make our bodies as attractive as they can be, but here's the deal. The flip side of that is, guys, your wife should be, must be, has to be the standard for beauty in your eyes. We live in a culture that is image-driven with images of women everywhere. And I want to tell you that men who tend to look at other images will speak silently into their wife that she is flawed and that she is not beautiful in his eyes, even though he doesn't mean to do it. And Solomon is saying, listen, I find you the most attractive, the most beautiful, the most wonderful, the most incredible woman I've ever seen. In my eyes, there are no flaws in you. How do you get there? By loving your wife. When you love her, you give yourself away to her. She will become that to you. But when you divide your visual and your loyalties, you won't. Let's go on. Verse 8. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana and the peak of Senir and Hermon and the dens of lions and the mountains of leopards. He's saying, listen, leave. This is kind of, he's talking about where she's from. Leave your cares and your worries and leave your home and just come be with me. I will care for you. Our relationship, our intimate relationship will be more than just something that happens in the bedroom. It will be something that protects you. And I will now be your provider and your protector. Verse 9. You've captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You've captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better better is your love than wine. Isn't this gorgeous? How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. It's a reference to kissing, intimate, passionate kissing. And the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Now, once again, great imagery. He's saying, listen, your sexuality is like a garden that is locked. This was very common in that culture where they would grow big, beautiful, and elaborate gardens, but they would also fence them off and put hedges around them. And they would have a significant gate. And they basically felt like a garden inside my courtyard is for the pleasure of those who are close to me and those alone. And he says, listen, your sexuality, your intimacy is like a garden that has been locked. And you only allow one person in. I love that about you, is what he's saying. That I am the only one that you allow in your garden. And then he starts talking to her in this garden imagery. And I just want to tell you, actually, all through Song of Solomon, if your first thought is, I wonder if he's talking about that. He is. I won't spell it out to you because then I will get fired. Okay? Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all its choicest fruit, henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, and all the trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes with all chief spices, a garden fountain, a well of living water, and flowing streams from Lebanon. What great imagery. He speaks the language of his wife's heart. He calls out to her. He loves her verbally. He lets her know how deep and how passionate, how wonderful she is, how attracted he is to her, how she is the center of his sexuality, and it matters. Guys, we generally, now you need to hear me say, as I talk about this in a few minutes, about all of this, stereotypes can be very dangerous because not everybody fits in any mold. I'm not saying that. But generally, guys, we want the physical end without touching the heart. And we wonder why our spouses don't want to be close to us. And it's because they don't know how to be close physically until they're close relationally. Period. And it is the man's job to take the initiative on that level. And so he speaks her heart language. He loves on her. And he says all this. Verse 16. He says, awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow up on my garden, let spices flow. And then look at her response. She, let my beloved come into his garden and eat its choicest fruits. That's all she says. Let's go for it, baby. Yes. It's that simple. Some of you later is like, I can't believe. It's like one of the episodes of Everybody Loved Raymond where he's kind of flirting with her and she's kind of beating around a bush and she won't really say what she's thinking. And finally she goes, what do you want me to say? Let's do it, baby. He goes, I would love it if you would speak to me like that. I mean, this is where she's just kind of like, yes, my garden's open. Let's go. But do you see in this? He knows his wife. She knows him. This whole book is an exchange of this love. I don't have a lot of time to tell you all the things that I think you could be thinking about in this. But let me just tell you a couple that I think are general and that you and your spouse ought to spend a lifetime figuring each other out, speaking each other language, being sensual and relational and romantic and loving, and just learning what it means to be you two in love with each other. That's marriage. And that's part of one of the big reasons God gave us sex. For men generally, when it comes to this issue, are a microwave. I mean, when it comes to sex, I mean, all she had to do is spin the timer 30 seconds, ding, he's done. You know, that's men. It's the way generally we are wired. Anytime, anywhere, for any reason, that's just who we are. Women, on the other hand, are more like crockpots most of the time. Women, there's a book that came out several years ago that was written to men, but the title of the book was called Sex Begins in the Kitchen. And that's not some weird kinky thing, okay? This is trying to tell guys, listen, if you think that you can wait till the end of the evening and then flirt with your wife and that's going to work, you're sadly mistaken. You need to touch her heart before you try to touch her body. And it needs to be an all-day process. Men are compartmentalized. Women are holistic. Men are physically oriented generally. Women are relationally oriented generally. And this is what happens. So many times, this is what happens. Men see sex as the fulfillment of the compartmentalized microwave physical end of the relationship. Women, their sexuality is more about the relational, close, holistic fulfillment. And when we are trying to fulfill the part that is us without thinking about how to fulfill the part that is the other person, sex doesn't work. It's just not the completing, physical, beautiful, deep relationship. It is when I begin to give myself away to my spouse and understand her that it all works. I have so much in my notes I'd love to share with you. I can't. But I just want to tell you that this is the bottom line. That most of us are struggling, if you are struggling in your sex life with your spouse, it's because both of you see sex as a way to fulfill your needs instead of a way to reach out and meet the needs of the other person. God's plan, know your partner. And then I just want to address a couple issues, a couple problems. Not in detail, but there are things that I got to be honest, my dad was ridiculously candid about sexuality, okay? He was. Sometime privately, I will tell you stories that will have you cackling and laughing, especially if you know my dad. Because he's a guy who's been in church all his life, straight-laced. But when it came to these issues, when he talked to me, he didn't hold back, okay? It was weird. But I'm thankful, all right? but he answered some questions that the Bible actually answers that I think a lot of people haven't ever had answers. And I'm just going to talk about two things real quick. Two problems that I think you need to be aware of in your marital relationship. You might think of how do we deal with this? And the first one is this. It is struggling with the overarching question of the evening. Now, I realize not everybody is like this. It may be different for you, but in my relationship with my wife and a lot of people that we've counseled, the overarching question, which is tonight the night, is something that kind of drives people in their relationships. And it's a tough thing. Let me put it like this. This is what happened. Husband comes home, or the wife comes home. It's evening. And for the guy, in most relationships, for the guy, he is trying to figure out how to love his wife. But that overarching question is on his mind from the beginning. My wife once asked me, she said, I want you to take a notebook, and I want you to jot down all the times you think about sex. And I looked at her, and I was real honest. I said, you don't want to know that information. She's like, no, seriously. I looked at her and I said, no, you don't want to know that. And you're like, oh, you're a pastor. That's right. I'm also a man. We are like this, okay? And a guy comes home generally and he's thinking about this, but it's not that he's like just consumed, oh, I must. He doesn't know how to respond to his wife as long as that question is out there. And so he is thinking about it. Meanwhile, she is not. Generally, I tell you, I'm over, you may be different, but she is not thinking about it. She's thinking about dinner and the kids and all this other sort of stuff. And what needs to happen, you need to figure out a way in your relationship so that you flip-flop those and learn how to deal with that question early. What frustrated, and this is the only time I'm really going to bring up our relationship. I'm not telling you everything about us. Notice that other than just alluding to the fact that I'm married, I've avoided that. But here's the deal. In our relationship, it became a major point of tension. Because for me, I didn't know how to deal with the frustration of not knowing until it was time for us to go to bed. I didn't know how to respond to my wife. I didn't know how to love her. But as long as the answer might be yes, I kept flirting and pushing, which for her made her feel like she was an object. But she wasn't. I just wanted to be close to her and intimate. I just didn't know how to deal with the overarching question, and she didn't either. Now, we've come up with a strategy, and I'm not going to share that strategy with you. If you want to know, email me. I'll tell you what it is. But I will tell you this much. Come up with a way to deal with the question and deal with it early. Come up with a way where early in the evening, there is some communication in the context of a 1 Corinthians 7 sex life where you deal with the question. What happens is when the husband knows yes or no early and he is content with the answer to that question, he will then be able to love his wife in a way that knows which direction this is going. And I just want to tell you, in a lot of married couples I've counseled, it's a huge issue. It was for us. Learn how to deal with that huge overarching question that hovers over the relationship, especially for the guy. Learn how to deal with it, okay? Maybe you resolve it that, maybe you don't. The second question is, this is weird, okay? I know, but nobody will answer this. I'm going to. What sexually is acceptable in marriage? What can we do? Now, I'm not going into a lot of detail on this other than to tell you that the book of Song of Solomon makes it pretty clear that pretty much anything in the context of a healthy sexual relationship is okay if the two people are okay with it, with one exception. Anything that creates desire for a third person or more is not. Anything that the two of you do sexually as a married couple that is about the two of you, I think the Bible condones it and encourages it and tells you have fun and enjoy. But things like visuals and pictures and using porn to love one another, I want to tell you, is dangerous, it's forbidden by Scripture, it's sinful, and will wreak more havoc than you want to know. And so, there's the answer. Men, communicate some of those things. Women, struggle through them, but be willing to be a little adventurous sometimes. Now, here's the deal. We have projects, and for married couples, I really hope you'll pick up your project on the way out, because it's a challenge to kind of walk through some of these issues together and figure out how you can give yourself away. But that's what it's about. And the reason God has given us this beautiful thing, this beautiful intimacy and relationship, is because as I learn both sexually and non-sexually how to be about my wife and to love her and to give myself away from her, and I learn how to invest myself into all that she is, I understand in a greater way what it means to trust Jesus and Jesus only. I understand the fact that he gave everything just for me. And it really is a way for me in a greater way to understand the gospel. And that's why God gave us sex. I'm going to close this morning by showing you two resources and encouraging you to go to Amazon.com and buy them. There are not many good sex books out there. Even the Christian ones, I'll be honest, most of them run to secular ideas and try to package secular sexuality and throw a little Christian spin on it, and it doesn't deal with the deeper things of the theology of sex, and I think that's a big part of it, okay? The first one, and it's kind of crazy that these books are actually being written, but they are, and it's good. The first one is called Sex and the Supremacy of Christ. It is edited by John Piper and Justin Taylor. It is actually from a conference that they did on this, and there are some great guys in here and ladies writing on the issue of sexuality. Now, if you're a husband and wife, you're writing this down, great. Listen, single folks, this book is written for you too. There are great chapters written to people who are preparing for marriage or people who are following 1 Corinthians 7 and saying, listen, that's not part of my life yet, and how do I flesh that out? It is a wonderful book. Just to help you walk through some real key issues. And the second one is this, Sex, Romance, and the Glory of God by a guy named C.J. Mahaney. Sex, Romance, and the Glory of God, What Every Christian Husband Needs to Know. And this is a book that is written to men, primarily, although the last chapter is written to wives. And the book walks through the book of Song of Solomon. And what it does is it tries to speak to men and say, listen, touch your heart before you try to touch your body. And it talks about great ways as a man we can learn to do that. Guys, we really need to learn that. Ladies, you need to figure out that your husband, you touch his heart when you touch his body. Most guys. Wrestle through these things. Understand, God does have a good plan. It's spelled out. That is to know your partner, to know your spouse, to give yourself away, to walk through these problems, whatever other ones, and to have a great sex life. Because I really believe it is God's plan for follower of Jesus to have the best sex lives on this planet. And I hope this will help you go in that direction. I'm going to pray. The band's going to come out here. We're going to worship. We're going to worship because really all of life is about Jesus. All of life is about the fact that he loves us. He redeems us. He gives us grace. He gives us glory. He gives us hope. He gives us purpose. And even if there's failure and struggles in this issue, look to him to be the healer. We're going to worship because he's good. As we worship, we're going to be collecting our offering. If you're a guest with us, the offering is not for you. We do an offering because it is an act of worship for those who are part of Genesis. But if you're a guest, this service is our gift to you. Please don't give. We love you. We appreciate you. I'm going to pray, and we're going to worship. God, I love you, and I just honor you today because you are a good God. And I just pray this morning as we worship, you will set our hearts on you. And Lord, I pray that with this issue, I pray that you will continue to help us build strong, healthy, God-centered, Christ-centered marriages. In your name I pray. Amen.